the Old Testament, the book of Ruth, and its third chapter. I think we have to say, you know, that the motivation in the first three chapters of Ruth is feminine, which inclines me further to believe that it was Naomi's idea in the first place to leave for Moab during the famine. And while that was obviously a wrong move, as was proved by the death of her husband and her two sons, she learned from her mistake bitterly, as we know. And although initiative remained with her as a widow on her own with a dependent daughter-in-law, also widowed, her initiatives thereafter were God-guided. And even the escape to Moab was part of God's permissive will. He permitted it in order to incorporate this Moabite woman in the royal line of Judah leading to Christ, David and Christ. Someone remarked after last Sunday evening's service and message that they did not enjoy the first part of the discourse, because we raked up the sordid nature of the origins of the tribe of Judah. And I agreed with that. I didn't enjoy it either, because it was unsavory. But I still think it was important for us to see clearly that the one whom God sent, his own son, who was to be, if I may put it thus, the man for sinners who knew no sin, it was right that he should have an appropriately sinful ancestry as to his human nature. Perhaps that's a daring thing to say, but surely it's true. And while it may well have been the misguided initiative of Naomi to take her family off to Moab during the famine, and it certainly was on her repentant initiative, guided by God, to return home empty, as she said herself, to resume her life in the tribe of Judah, bringing her widowed daughter-in-law with her to be incorporated into the life of the royal line of Judah. The initiative in chapter 2 was undoubtedly Ruth's, that she might assist her mother-in-law to make ends meet, rather than sell off precipitately her piece of land. That initiative of Ruth's led to the astonishing coincidence, I use coincidence in a special sense, not in the chance sense, but in the sense of God bringing surprising things together by his design, like the courtships and marriages of some of you. That kind of coincidence. Blessed coincidence. That initiative led to the astonishing coincidence of Ruth gleaning in Boaz's field, which gave Naomi sufficient assurance to believe that a divine strategy was beginning to appear in the life of this young woman. And being womanlike, if I may dare to say so, not slow to perceive a divine plot, she took the whole initiative in hand and sought to advance the budding romance which was to lead to the marriage of Ruth and Boaz, ancestors of David and Christ. I have a letter from George Robertson from Botswana to say, he notes from the last record, the May record, that I had quoted John Calvin in a letter he wrote to John Knox, approving the leadership of women as a judgment of God upon men. And George wonders what Calvin would have said about, and I quote, "You're using his words to support the entry of a woman into the ministry." I get his point. But I still see my support of Shirley Fraser's induction to Tillydrone on the 17th of this month as an exception to the rule. I hold to that and no one will shift me from it. But Calvin's words certainly fully apply to both Naomi's and Ruth's initiatives in this book. And now to Naomi's again in chapter 3. Indeed, she is actually commissioning her daughter-in-law to adopt an initiative which even in our day of the overturning of so many of our cherished conventions, takes our breath away. Talk about a feminine proposal of marriage. Well, perhaps it's not so uncommon as we think. But then, a designing woman would never let it be known, even in our day, that she was proposing marriage. It would all have to appear as if it was by the man's initiative, although the mechanics were, in fact, largely female-designed. Here, there is no attempt to hide the feminine initiative at all. And there is a healthy honesty about that, which is surely refreshing. And the whole thing is justified on account of there being no males in the family, apart from Boaz, to play a man's part. The only male involved is Boaz. And, you know, whether his harlot mother's past had any effect on him or not, it is clear that this man, in his maturity, see chapter 3, verse 10, is not married yet. And although it is plain from chapter 2 that he is attracted to this diligent woman gleaner and deliberately sought to favor her before the eyes of his other workers, he may have been slow enough to take the initiative and propose marriage, for him to need at least a little push. This is all that any designing woman would admit to, although Naomi is obviously not at all ashamed of her initiative. Well, who was to advance the settlement of Moabite Ruth in Judah if the only man around, for all his attraction to her, was slow to act? Someone had to do something where two helpless, notice, helpless widows were concerned. And Israel was always deeply concerned for widows and orphans. So Naomi's advice is for Ruth to take decisive action. After all, you know, it was by apparently divine coincidence that Ruth found herself gleaning in Boaz's field, and it was surely of God that the man showed such extreme favor to the young woman. It began and continued with such dignity and chastity. And I think while we read that chapter, if you were sometimes holding your breath and wondering, if you hadn't read it before, what you were going to read or what I was going to read next, that would show how inclined we all are to be suspicious. Nothing could have been chaster than what was done. And it all began, you see, as the best romances do, with friendship and mutual respect. You know, I've got in my manuscript there Charlie Abel, and I'm wondering whether I'll tell you this story. I think I will. Charlie Abel, lately the moderator of the Presbyterian Church in New South Wales, when he was a divinity student in Aberdeen, was an awful flirt. And he loved dolly girls, and we all used to tease him about it, the young rascal. But at the same time, he developed a particular friendship for Mary from Stornoway, and she would be different, of course, wouldn't she? And she was. And he kept saying to me, of course, it's only friendship. We go walks together, walks along the sands, and it's only friendship. It's only friendship. And we enjoy one another's company so much, and we talk about so many things. Then one Saturday evening, before the prayer meeting, or was it after the prayer meeting, he came down the little aisle and said to me, with his face shining, "I'm in love." I said, "Oh, Charlie, with whom?" And he looked at me with such surprise and said, "Mary, of course." I said, "That's very surprising. I thought that was only platonic." You see, and a happier marriage you wouldn't find, I should think. Well, now, if Boaz didn't see that our most appropriate and attractive marriage was staring him in the face, and there's not the slightest hint that he or any of them was concerned that she was a foreigner, that didn't enter into it. Then it was time for a woman to act. And so she did, both the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. But Naomi came round to it, of course, as we would say in Scotland, cannily enough. Was it not time for her, she speculated, was it not time for her to be looking for a home, which meant marriage, of course, looking for a home for her daughter-in-law? And there was this Boaz, related to Naomi's late husband, Elimelech, and even related by marriage to Ruth as the widow of Elimelech's son, Mahlon. And all the signs were, surely this is the silent implication of Naomi's advice, wouldn't you think? All the signs were that the man was attracted to Ruth. And so, now's the time. Naomi made it her business to know Boaz's movements at harvest time. He would be threshing that evening. And, of course, that may have been related to the evening breeze, which we are told is common in that land, between 4 o'clock and dusk, 6 o'clock, 6:30. For the threshing process was by the trampling feet of the animals to separate the husks from the grain, and then the winnowing was by casting the grain into the air, that the wind might blow away the chaff and the heavier grain fall to the threshing floor. Leon Morris, the commentator, the Tyndale commentator on Ruth, suggests that Boaz may have decided to stay the night by the grain to protect it from thieves, which I thought was an astonishing idea, although in very different communities, say in our own land, harvesting generally calls for a suspension of normal routines. And it might have been expected that the owner of the field would simply lie down for the night beside his produce until it was gathered up and stored in barns. Perhaps Leon Morris is not so far from it after all. At all events, this was obviously the common practice, so that Naomi was assured that it would be so that night. And it was. So Ruth was to prepare for the romantic adventure of paying special attention to her appearance, bathing, anointing herself with suitable unguents, toilet preparations, and dressing herself suitably, whether that means special clothes or not, the text doesn't say. The man Boaz, on his part, replete with a full meal at the end of his day's work, and obviously in a relaxed and cheerful mood, doubtless helped on by imbibing, was ready to lie down and would soon be asleep. So the girl was to wait until he was fast asleep, and then go and uncover the foot of the outer garment he would use as a blanket. Exodus 22 and 26. Listen, if you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it to him by sunset, because his cloak is the only covering he has for his body. What else will he sleep in? You see. And so, he would cover himself with his outer garment, his cloak. And she would uncover the cloak and lie down. This, of course, according to the custom, was in fact nothing less than a proposal of marriage. And that, you may have thought, is the most surprising thing in the whole chapter. And I suppose it is. And the justification for such a presumptuous action by the woman would have been Naomi's assumption that Boaz was her late husband Elimelech's nearest kin, which he turned out not to be. All took place up to that point just as designing mama-in-law had planned it, until in the middle of the night something startled the sleeping Boaz, and he awoke to find a damsel lying at his feet. In his sudden surprise and embarrassed confusion, he asked the woman who she was. "I am your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a goel of mine, a kinsman redeemer." With obviously family obligations. Now, the word can refer to the obligation to rescue a near relative from slavery. Leviticus 25 and 48 following. Or it can refer to redeeming, that is, retrieving by buying back a field which, having belonged to the family, had been sold on account of poverty. This would be related to the divine insistence that the land belongs to the Lord. Leviticus 25 and 23 says that the land belongs to the Lord, and he portioned it out to the tribes. And he portioned it out to the tribes as in the book of Joshua, and they are not to give it away or forfeit it in any way or transfer it from clan to clan. You see. Now, the word goel, because redeemer comes into it, has certain gospel implications, obviously. Although, this is the interesting thing, which surprised me. I don't know that I knew this before. I should have done. Although there is no subsequent biblical reference to the word to connect it with our Messiah, Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Isn't that interesting? But of course, the idea is so suggestive of our kinsman, Jesus Christ, coming to redeem us and buy us back from perdition, so that it is perhaps too obvious for any discerning Bible reader to miss it. Wouldn't you agree? Boaz's surprise and apparent delight at the young woman's matter-of-fact approach is plain to be seen. It appears that he, a man of mature years and for some reason unmarried, although attracted to the young woman, would not have expected her to regard him as an eligible prospective husband. Too old. But stranger things have happened than that. Boaz is obviously wide awake by now, and uninhibitedly enthusiastic about the idea. What a mouthful of gracious encouragement to the girl he pours out. It's really quite thrilling. 10th verse of chapter 3. "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good. Well, he says good anyway. Let him redeem. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, says this old bachelor, I will do it. Lie here until morning. Now, one of the things which will surely strike us, these loose living days, is the sheer purity and the dignity of the whole proceeding. You see, it would be impossible for some minds to read this without being sullied, because that's the way they think. But no. Whereas the promiscuous of our generation will look on this as laughably innocent and hardly believe it. But then, given over to the free indulgence of all their native lusts without restraint, it would be a situation absolutely unheard of by many of our generation, and hardly believed by them at all. They'd say, oh, ho, ho, wouldn't they? But you see, there is still chastity in the world. Did you know? Goodness, that would be news to some young people today. That there is still chastity in courtship. Yes, it would be news. And by God's grace, and we have already taken notice of Boaz's grace to his employees, it is still possible today to live a pure and unsullied life. There was, of course, the matter of the nearer kinsman to consider. Boaz would attend to that in the morning. And Naomi was sure that he would attend to it that day. She perhaps knew him better than he knew himself in some ways. But if the nearer kin did not wish to buy back Elimelech's land and marry his widowed daughter-in-law, then Boaz would be more than pleased to oblige. Meantime, Ruth was to lie at his feet until morning and then slip away quietly so that no one might know that a woman had lain there all night. For all, you see the reason for that, all would not be as innocent in their thoughts as the facts called for. And very often, I think we've perhaps seen that in court cases, things are not as black as they are painted. We need to beware of suspicious minds in respect of others. Admittedly, such innocence is not very common nowadays, for amidst the free indulgence of so many of the young living together in fornication before marriage, it is wonderful to find some who are not only indoctrinated in the gospel, which knowledge of itself doesn't guarantee personal purity, since some of the vilest people are biblically literate. But is it not wonderful to find some who are not only indoctrinated in the gospel today, but are held fast by the gospel's holy laws, maintaining sexual purity and retaining the highest respect for the seventh commandment and abstaining from every appearance of evil and shunning the very thought of fornication? The understanding of Ruth's and Naomi's penurious state and Boaz's generosity to the girl is simply another sign of the complete nobility and generosity of this man's character. He is just everything that a Christian should be. And such an example needs to be held forth today to the minds of young people, to show them what the grace of God can do in the midst of an evil generation and the generation of judges, as we have read at the end of that book, was exceedingly evil indeed. Don't forget that all this moral beauty and near moral perfection of godly behavior is absolutely contemporaneous with the sordidness that we found at the end of the book of Judges, which has shocked us deeply in recent weeks. We have here nothing less than a pocket of the purest righteousness and winsomest grace in the midst of a world full of godless disgrace and lawless debauchery. And you see, this is what we are called to, even if we seem to make little apparent impact upon our day by our life here, even by the witness of our text board and the focus upon the rebuilding of our spire, which will soon be an object of rare beauty. We long to make impact upon people one way or another. Oh, that people would inquire within the walls of this edifice to discover the possibilities of deeper beauties than those of sculpture. Stone, even those displayed so graciously in the story of this wonderful man. The son, remember? The son of a one-time harlot and brothel keeper. And yet, showing forth the virtues of a Christian gentleman, whose like you would scarcely see in the pages of the New Testament, the Lord Jesus Christ himself apart. And the dedicated chasteness of this young widow, so devoid of artifice and carnal seduction, talk about the beauty of holiness. How lovely it is. How lovely holiness is when you see it in real live flesh and blood. Beautiful. Of course, purity and pellucid honesty angers some people. We know that. That's what maddened the Pharisees at Jesus. But to those who are susceptible to purity and moral beauty, and there must be many such in Aberdeen, It surely means something to encounter honest, open faces. Now, this is how I would like to see our congregation to those who happen into church. Honest, open faces. A warm, non-ingratiating smile. With kindly words and a genuine and forced concern for the welfare of others. It seems to me, you see, that if all the Bible teaching we encompass is to have its proper desired effect, it must issue in a center of such warmth and care, as I think must have emanated from Boaz's home farm. Do you remember the first night they met? He gave Ruth some roasted grain, and I suggested it came from his kitchen. That must have been a center of love. The home of Boaz's mother. Was she still alive? Rahab the... No, not the harlot anymore, but the mother of this most gracious gentleman. You know, grace is wonderful. Isn't it? When it is like a pocket of heaven in a trough of hell. And when you think of the patience of God with his fallen creation. But he knows what he's doing, all right. And because we don't know very much what he's doing, we must be patient. Dare I say this? Since he is so patient with us, we must learn to be patient with him. Sometimes we're not. Lord, do it, and do it quick. We must be patient with him and believe that walking with him is the most we can do to further his purposes, known and unknown, including his purposes of incorporating all sorts of odd souls. Like you and me, into his kingdom. He loves variety. And I really think I must say that he loves odd bods, or he wouldn't have made so many of them. How lovely to incorporate them into Christ in, what was I calling it from Evangeline Booth, was it this morning? The greatest romance in the world, incorporating them into the love story of God and his Christ. For poor, sinful humanity. What a thing to live for. Oh, friends, aren't we fortunate? when you think of the thousands in Aberdeen for whom this means little or nothing, or seems to. Aren't we fortunate tonight to have access into the greatest thing in the world, the love of God?